Hello and welcome to A Big Country. I'm Edwina Farley. Today, forget about going to the supermarket or fruit shop to buy your greens for dinner. We're foraging for edible weeds on a roadside in northern Tasmania. Talking about food, get reacquainted to the old-fashioned Rosella fruit and hitch a ride on a cane train in tropical North Queensland. These little locos are kept busy during the harvest period. And we also squeeze in a trip to the Kimberley region in Western Australia, where rural reporter Tom Edwards picks up a fishing rod and tries to bag a barra.
Keep winding. There we go.
Whoa!
Tom's on to a big fish here.
Whoa, he jumped!
That's
woo!
A big fish.
What ensued was a grueling battle between man and fish that was just as much about wit as it was stamina. One moment my opponent flipped through the air, then it floated on the surface, only to shoot off like a bullet into the rapids.
Does he land the fish, or is steak still on the menu tonight? You'll have to stay listening to find out. Right now though, let's jump in the car and see what's on the menu for one keen food forager in northern Tasmania.
Where are you taking me today, Alex?
We're going out to the highway to pick some yarrow, which grows on the side of the road there. There's also hawthorn flowers, which are not edible at this time of year, but that's something that I do as part of making things look pretty.
I go to the supermarket or the fruit and veg shop to get my greens, but Alexandra Snepp, well, she gets in her car and goes looking for them in backyards, along the side of the road, anywhere she can find them.
There's also lots of wild brassica that grows along the side of the highway there, which is flowering at this time of year. It looks beautiful. The flowers are also edible.
Hello, I'm Hilary Burden. Alexandra is an avid forager, looking for herbs, edible flowers and weeds in and around the city of Launceston in northern Tasmania. I've joined this self-trained plant scientist and kitchen gardener on one of her weekly gathering trips, collecting tasty bits and pieces for a local cafe.
So you've just picked me up from the ABC and we're heading through the streets of East Launceston. Do you drive everywhere you go? Are you on the outlook all the time?
Always with my eyes in the trees and on the ground. Always. I haven't crashed yet.
What about when you pass a house and there's something in someone's front garden? Are you one of these people who knock on the front door, or how do you approach something you really, really want?
I have been known to knock on the door and ask if I can just grab a few pieces of fruit off their tree if they've got lots, or a cutting, or if they can just tell me what that plant is.
Yes,
I've done that more than a few times.
It's quite ironic that you're not going to the country, you're coming from the country to the city. What is Launceston providing?
There is such a variety of plants in the city that are just not in the country areas.
For example?
There's a lot of edible weeds in the city that I guess don't have the chance to be cultivated in the country areas. And I think that has a lot to do with just so many people gardening and bringing so many plants in and around the area, that they have a much larger variety that has more chance to spread.
And do you think people know what they are, that they're edible?
No, absolutely not, which is why they're weeds.
Part of your what you do and your association with Phoenix and the Wolf in Perth and Chef Sean Keating, how would you just explain your role and what you provide?
Providing unusual plants in season, things that can't be bought from any of the providers, any of the providors. Small herbs that can otherwise be difficult to cultivate, but, you know, give them a vacant block of land or a gutter or a side of the road somewhere, they'll grow really well. Just providing more of a variety, and also opening people's eyes to what are these things? I didn't know that was edible, and are you sure you're feeding me something edible here? I'm sure I've seen that growing on the side of the road.
Have you got this knowledge? Have you studied books? Have you had someone influence you? What's the background?
I've always been interested in plants and edible weeds, and I came across the Weed Forager's Handbook. It was recommended by somebody online years ago, and I bought that, and that's a really great resource. But I'm always fascinated, like, what is this? And so I'll take a photo of something I don't know and go and look it up, see see if I can find it in a book or just the description of it into Google and see what we can find from there.
So we're crossing over Hobbs Bridge Road and going into St Leonard's, getting greener, but Launceston is a pretty green city anyway, isn't it? So you find a lot of resources in parks.
Yes, definitely in parks, in vacant blocks of land and street trees. There's a lot of street trees which have edibles. So Dianella is one of the council's, all council's favourite plants to plant in parks and those sorts of things, because it's a lovely just low maintenance grass looking plant. But it has these lovely little purple flowers and purple berries, which are a native bush tucker food. And different varieties taste better than others, obviously, but they're all edible. So we're just pulling over on the side of the highway here. It's a very rural area. There's some trees, lots of paddocks, cows. But there's also roadside herbs. So we're going to pick some yarrow.
Salad burnet. Everywhere. Wow.
You're surprised.
Yes, I couldn't see that from driving past. I can see the flowers, but it's not till I stop and go, I recognise those seed heads.
Corner, oh my god, way. And there's so much of it. Fantastic.
It's like she's in salad burnet heaven.
I am, absolutely. I think I'll definitely be picking some of this as
And so you, the things that you have as a forager, I've got noticed in your back pocket, they go everywhere with you, those secateurs?
Those secateurs go everywhere with me. They are, if they're not in my back pocket, they're in the car, they're in my bag. They're with me at all times. I have buckets, baskets, containers, all sorts of things in my car at all times. There's little hacksaw, little fold-up hacksaw in the glove box for cutting off stubborn branches and... Often a pair of scissors or two floating around as well.
Oh, that's bright yellow. Is that...
So this is brassica as well.
Oh,
you can tell by the shape of the leaves, the stems and the seeds.
And you're tasting it for edibility, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's actually quite tasty. That's quite peppery. It's a mustard, but the leaves... Probably the smaller leaves are a little more tender.
Mm-hmm. Looks like a rocket leaf, actually.
Yes, so they're a little bit tougher. Wild brassicas are a lot tougher, always.
They're quite peppery.
And so rocket has been bred to have much softer, lusher leaves, a lot more moisture in them.
Wow, that's got some punch, actually.
Wild oats.
And wild oats,
yep,
right next to...
Yep. So when you see the farmer chewing on an oat straw, that's this stuff.
He really does.
He really does, because it's quite sweet. The seed heads and the stems themselves can be quite sweet to chew on.
Well, the sound of bicyclists going past, roosters in the back garden and traffic on the road, here we are in amongst a forest of herbs. So, Alex, thanks for letting me join you today on your foraging trip in Launceston.
Thank you very much for coming along. It's been a pleasure.
I reckon Rosella is quite sexy because it's so versatile. You can make a Rosella jam. I make Rosella cordial, and it's actually rich on vitamin C as well, and it's actually got antioxidant in it. And then I make Rosella syrup, Rosella chutney, I've got Rosella tea.
Just 4 years ago, CC Peterson had never heard of Rosellas. Now she's a complete convert. Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols at the Gympie Growers Markets on Queensland's Kulula Coast, where CC and her husband Greg are doing a brisk trade with their sexy fruit products.
What do you think about the market? Good?
Rosellas grow in a shrub up to 1.5 metres high. It has reddish leaves and yellow hibiscus-like flowers that develop into the distinctive dark red fruit. They have 2,500 Rosella plants growing on their small farm at Woolooga near Gympie, with 16 of their 20 hectares devoted to growing other small crops.
We're pretty much what we call a gourmet farm, so we grow niche products like your Rosellas. We grow things like gem squash, which is South Africans love. We have cassavas. You can see the cassavas here that are stalled at the moment. Gooseberries and all that. Gourmet tomatoes. A lot of Asian vegetables. chilies, because we make a lot of chili sauces. So pretty much the way for us to be able to evolve in this kind of market, we've got to listen to the market. And because we're small farmers, we can pretty much do a shift in 6 months. If there's a demand for gem squash, well, what we'll do is we'll grow gem squash.
A talented cook, Cece was born in the Philippines. She didn't even know Rosellas existed before she met Greg at her market stall. He'd been growing them for decades.
I started growing them about 35 years ago, sent to the Brisbane markets, and never made much money out of them until we moved up here to Gympie. Started growing gooseberries because they were growing wild on the property. Then started back on Rosellas. And the gooseberries is how I met my wife.
Cece needed a good supply of gooseberries for her jam. So friends put her in touch with farmer Greg. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So anyway, here comes Greg. He said to me, apparently you're chasing gooseberries. And I said, yes. And I think he gave me goosebumps.
Big yellow ones.
And then from then he started, oh, what about Rosellas? Have you ever had your Rosellas? I said, what's a Rosella? So he was my supplier and I'm the cook, and everything just stemmed from there, and it's pretty much the marriage of the farmer and the cook.
Without going on television.
Can you make enough money out of this to sustain yourselves?
Yeah, we get by. Yeah, enough to keep you going. Won't become millionaires, but it's a happy environment. Work when you got to and rest when you want to.
And the good thing is, because of the value adding, as soon as you put it in a jar, it's got a better shelf life. We can put value in it instead of us depending on the market to give us a price. You can't even get Rosella jam in the supermarket. Guess what? If you want a lot of it, just call CC and I can give you so much, because we've got about 1.4 ton of Rosellas put away on cold storage to keep us sustained for the next 6 months.
How many will you harvest in a year, Greg Peterson?
We start picking in January till about the 1st of June. We've done 4.1 ton so far. We should nudge the 5 ton quite easily.
That's a whole lot of work involved in that.
It's a lot of love.
Rosellas certainly proved to be a recipe for love for Sunshine Coast fruit growers Cece and Greg Peterson. Still to come on A Big Country today, catching a barra in the Kimberley and the view from on board a cane train crisscrossing tropical North Queensland during the sugarcane harvest.
Rosella. You get to work outdoors, you get to drive around on a train, and you know, the sunset, the sunrises, the scenery, it's awesome.
When you travel through Queensland's sugarcane districts, you can't help but notice the narrow gauge rail lines crisscrossing the countryside. They're part of an intricate cane train network that goes into overdrive during the busy 6 month harvest period, working day and night to get the cut cane to the mills for processing. G'day, I'm David Sparks. The harvest is drawing to a close for another year around Mackay and North Queensland, so I grabbed one last chance to jump on board one of these little green and yellow locomotives for a few hours. While I stand back and enjoy the scenery, driver's assistant Rose Ware is being kept busy jumping on and off the engine, hooking up the cane bins.
For me, it's just like I get off and I hook up and unhook all the bins and count them off. Yeah, throwing the points, sending them down the right line. And
throwing the points, you might have to explain that.
You know, these things that I just threw before.
Switching the track so that you're going one direction or the other.
Base
at
Broadstown, number to Homebush 12.
While I tag along today, Rose and driver Steve Bailey are starting with 70-odd empty bins at Racecourse Mill. We'll head out, drop the empties off at three different locations where the harvesters need them, and then start to gather fully loaded bins to bring back to the mill. Everything is coordinated from one central control station, communicating with the driver over radio.
Can you put 12 only in the open of 3 and leave the remaining 25 somewhere else? We'll have to get them taken.
So why do you travel from New Zealand every year to do this?
Because it's great.
How long does the season go for you?
Usually starts beginning of June, ends end of November. It's good, 6 months.
What do you do when you go back to New Zealand?
Last year I went and I worked in a high school boarding hostel and supervised the kids, just get free board and food and look after the kids for so many hours a week, and then I just visited my friends.
So are you a, well, I'm trying to think of a cliche I can use, like a wandering spirit or something like that? Or
No, I just reckon I'm pretty lucky. Yeah. I just, yeah, I get the best of both worlds.
Would you struggle to stay in one place all year?
No, because I did my whole life until I came here and did this. Like, I stayed in one town and raised two sons and didn't go anywhere. So this is, now it's like, yeah, they left and I'm out of there.
The sheer scale of the operation to run this network of cane trains is probably best told in numbers. For Mackay Sugar's three mills in the region, it has 32 engines plus three spare and 8,000 bins. When a cane train is fully loaded, the engine has to tow 1,000 tonnes. All the rail tracks required to service the three mills cover a total of 800 kilometres.
Thanks to Shannon.
Shannon.
Steve, you're cleaning out what's left on line 3 in the MCI, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, it'll be clear.
While it is fascinating to watch, this is also an important part of the region's economy. The need for so many workers to keep the cane trains going makes it a serious source of employment, both for locals and for those who travel in from far afield to work flat out for the season and make the most of their opportunity. Steve says being a driver has worked out well for him.
How long have you been doing this, Steve?
Probably about 15 years.
Yeah, right, so you must like it. Why do you keep coming back?
Oh, it's a good job. I like it. And you're outside all the time.
How did you become a loco driver?
They were asking for DAs or driver's assistance. And I applied and it was successful in that. So after a couple of years, you get your logbook and to get your ticket and then you get assessed and then you're a driver.
So would most people be a driver's assistant before they become a driver?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you have to be a driver's assistant first.
It's really good, and it's a lot better than anything sort of I've had at home. For being able to earn money, it's like before I came here, I was at the meatworks, and I didn't like that. You know, just indoors in a big, working in a big old fridge packing meat. It was like, no, I handle the season and I've got to do something different. Dairy farm work I've done at home, and that's really good, but yeah, can't beat this one.
Would you like to drive this thing one day, or you just want to be an assistant?
I actually like being a DA.
Yeah.
I like getting off on and off. I like the physical side. I like walking the bins and throwing the points, and yeah, I couldn't sit still.
Sounds like you've got quite an important coordinator's job, right?
Oh, yeah, a job's important. You work as a team, yeah, right, you know, right, and we are called driver's assistants. Some people like to say driver's advisor, but that's just a joke. Righto, just pulled them away a wee bit.
In total, the network hauls up to 40,000 tonnes of cane per day, racking up about 5 million tonnes for the entire season. There are 200 drivers and driver's assistants. Then there's the perennial problem of mixing a 1,000 tonne cane train with a road network filled with motorists in a hurry to get from point A to point B. Throughout the rail network, the cane trains have to contend with 450 road crossings, and just 100 of those have lights.
We're just going to drag your pulleys up this end of the side and get them out of your way a bit.
No, mate, thank you.
With all this fresh air flowing through the cabin, aka natural air conditioning, it's easy to see why Rose and Steve love their job so much. But this week, after 5 months of frantic activity, the whole thing comes to a stop.
You said you love the job, but by the time you get to the end of the season, are you kind of really ready for it to end, or what?
I'm never really ready for it to end. I imagine if I had to work into January when it got really hot, I would be ready for it to end. But I'm one of the ones that could just keep going a little bit longer.
Do you get a little bit sad when it's over?
Yes, but it's not that long until it's back again.
We're in the lower Ord section of the Ord River, and we're as far up Skull Rock as you can go in a boat, and we're just fishing some of the rapids there. This time of year, with being February, there's a few fish around, so it's quite good for us, but it's still a bit hot.
If you live in or you've visited the Kimberley region in the northeast of Western Australia, you've probably had a go at one of the top end's favourite pastimes, barramundi fishing. It's an obsession for people here, so after 8 months as the rural reporter based in Kununurra, I'm a bit embarrassed to admit I still haven't cast a line. Until today, that is. G'day, I'm Tom Edwards. Local Barra fisherman Paul Stewart has taken me under his wing, and we've set out at the crack of dawn on a tinny bound for one of his favourite fishing spots. Paul's been fishing these waters for the past 30 years, so if anyone can help me hook a barra, it's this bloke.
So what makes this a good place to fish for barramundi?
Just the rapids, being this time of year, the bait, if there is any around, generally like to hang around the rapids, and the fish obviously follow them up as well.
It's been a dry, wet season. What impact has that had on the fishing?
Again, we'll be struggling through the cooler months for us this year, again like last year. So we can make the most of it while it's warm now, but I think tourists might find it a little bit hard.
And from what you've seen, how healthy would you say the local barramundi population is?
Looking good so far. Well, for today it is. It does thin out a bit later on for the year. But hopefully we get a bit more rain this year to top it up again, because it's, they do tend to like a bit more water to come down the river so they come up.
What are your favourite barramundi fishing spots around here?
The one that we're at now, and generally just Wyndham, the Keep River, which is in the Northern Territory. They're all the favourite spots to go to. The Ord is the pick of it because it's close to town, and you've got lots of sections of the Ord you can fish, whether it be boat or whether it be off the land, so what we've grown up on, or my kids have grown up on.
What's the secret to catching a nice barramundi?
Putting in the right spot at the right time on the right day. that's about it. There's a lot of times when you can sit all day and catch nothing, but you've got to take the good with the bad there, so that's just Kimberley fishing.
It's not long before Paul spots a large barramundi cruising along next to the riverbank. I cast my line, and within seconds the fish hooks on.
Yep, keep winding. There we go. We got him.
Whoa!
Tom's on to a big fish here.
Whoa, he jumped! Woo!
What ensued was a grueling battle between man and fish that was just as much about wit as it was stamina. One moment my opponent flipped through the air. Then it floated on the surface, only to shoot off like a bullet into the rapids. 15 arm-aching minutes later, I was out of breath as Paul lifted the fish out of the water.
It's a lovely sized fish you've got there, Tom. They've broken over the 80 centimetres by the look of it, so unfortunately that one's probably got to go back. But them's the breaks up here.
What is it about barramundi fishing that you love so much?
What you've just experienced today, it's one of the things that hooks you, because you can see the fish. The lure comes past and they grab it. Obviously after that you've got to fight it in, and that unfortunately was a bit big, that fish that you caught there, Tom, so you won't be eating him tonight. Hopefully we can get one a little bit smaller for you. So.
And how important is it to return those fish which are under or oversized?
Very, because they're the breeding season. They're the next breeders. Anything over the 80 centimetres is a class as a female, so that's going to produce more fish. We all let them go now. Things have changed since I first started. Everything was no size limits, no bag limits really, so now it's down to a maximum of 2 you can take per person, as well as the slot limit of 55 up to 80 centimetres, so you've got to get it into that little area of size. So,
what's the best fish that you've ever caught?
Size-wise, it's probably just over about a metre 13, I think it was. We've all caught one throughout the family, so we've all got the metre club. Got to aim for bigger, but they generally don't get much bigger than that sort of around here. It was night time and it was on a tidal river full of crocodiles. It came in one piece, so crocodiles didn't get it.
We are on the lower Ord here. There's potentially saltwater crocodiles nearby. Is that ever far from your mind when you're fishing for barramundi in these places?
Yeah, it always makes you wary of what you do. You don't sort of splash around in the water too much, but they'll stay into the shallows if you're going to wash your face or refresh yourself or get a bucket of water. But be wary, they're there. You don't see them in the wet season because it's too hot. They stay in the water. But when the dry season's here, you see quite a number of saltwater crocodiles basking on the banks to keep warm. So yeah, that makes you realise what's in the river. As you've seen today, Tom, you didn't see any crocodiles because they're all in the water. You don't see them, but they're there. They've always been here and they always will. And you just got to fish around them. It's good to see crocodiles out there. They're part of the system, and they do their job, and we just got to keep out of their way.
Some good advice there from Kimberley fisherman Paul Stewart, helping reporter Tom Edwards bag his first barra. And that's it for another week. Join me, Edwina Farley, and the team at the same time next week when we'll bring you more stories from rural and regional Australia. Bye for now.
From the founder of Apple to comedian Andy Samberg. From the head of Netflix to the man who built the World Wide Web. From the creators of the record-breaking podcast Serial to startups that are breaking ground right here in Australia. If you want to hear from the movers and the shakers, media, technology and culture around Australia and the globe, there is literally one show. It also happens to be the most literally named show. Download this show with me, Mark Fennell. Media, technology, culture. Find it on the RN website now or on the ABC Radio app.